Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Total Soccer Show Weekend Review, where we look back on a weekend where Lukaku sent the Gunners to the shops. Inter Milan showed they still have their chops. RB Leipzig's performance deserved massive props. And Inter Miami showed they're no longer massive flops. For now. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today is a man who is as energetic and he gets the job done so well. He's everything that Anthony Martial as a centre forward is not right now. Taylor Rockwell.
That is well done, Ryan. That introduction made me have the hops. There we go. I'll keep the rhyming tradition going. Yes, it's good to be here. It's nice to talk to you, and it's nice to not talk about Anthony Martial.
So no more Man United talk for the rest of this hour. Is that what you're asking me, Taylor?
I mean, I think that should be the legal requirement. Yes, whenever they play as boring and poorly as they did, I think we can skip right past them.
All right, well, next week when they're good again, we'll pick that right back
up,
Taylor.
There we go. Hey, week one champions, though. They're week one champions, don't forget.
Week one champs for life.
Yeah.
Also here is the personification of a Danny Ings volley. Very satisfying, clinical, and reassuringly expensive. It's Joe Lowry.
Oh, I like the price tag part the most. And I also like how Taylor just threw in a random word that rhymed with the things you were saying that didn't relate at all. I don't have one of those, but... just pretend like I did, and it ended with ops.
Hey, it gave me hops. That worked. It was. He said I was energetic, hopping. Are
you trying to tell me that you jumped up and down in your little home recording podcast studio, Taylor? I don't think you've got enough ceiling for that, man.
Joe, I'm not your pops. I can't tell you what to do. Another one. I'll keep it going if that's what this requires.
Hey, you guys should stop.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That's enough. Also here.
I'm back in.
Excellent. Also here is a man who rips his shirt off just like Cristiano Ronaldo scoring a 94th minute offside header whenever he finishes a podcast. It's Graham Ruthven.
Yeah, and like Cristiano Ronaldo, I also look as foolish after it gets disallowed. And match ends in a draw. And you've kind of made a bit of a fool of yourself.
Indeed, quite a game that was. Maybe we'll touch on that a little later on in the podcast, Graham. But just for now, those blue and yellow shirts, which I dissed on a previous podcast, I thought they looked slightly better in the flesh or thrown on the floor by Ronaldo at the end of a game. But what were your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think they looked better. It was actually a bit of a trend this weekend because I also thought this one divides opinion, but the Manchester United kit with the yellow shorts, I was a fan. A lot of people were not. I thought that looked better actually on them, and the same with the Juventus kit. I like it, but it's so close. If it just wasn't a little bit so crazy, it could be an absolute classic. Like if it was just stripes across rather than zigzags. But yeah, I liked it.
That Man United kit, by the way, was very reminiscent of New York Red Bulls away kits. They've had a few in those exact shades, I'm quite sure. Joe and Taylor, I'm going to ask you to sit on the sidelines for a few minutes because I got a few questions for Graham based on events that we learned this weekend.
Oh, yeah. No. Yes, please.
firstly, you sent us a picture, Graham, of one of your dinners. Would you like to describe what that dinner was?
Oh, no. It was a deep fry. So it was a full pizza supper, as we would call it in Scotland, which is a deep fried pizza with chips, which are slightly thicker fries.
How do Americans have the reputation for being the fat ones? Like, how does that happen?
It's so good. And also a thing that I learned is that I think I might have mentioned deep fried pizza during my Italy preview of the Euros. Apparently that the roots of that are from Italy, from Naples. That's a deep fried pizza is a Naples thing. So ha! We're not destroying Italian cuisine. They're doing that for themselves.
It was the presentation that got me, Graham. The pizza, the deep fried pizza, was on top of the fries. It seemed like the wrong way round. And what kind of pizza was it? It looked like one of those very cheap microwave supermarket ones.
Oh yeah, that's part of the appeal. It has to be a cheap... I think that's maybe where we Scots have changed the Italian recipe. I think they probably do it with quite high-grade pizza, whereas the whole deal in Scotland is you want to do it with the cheapest pizza possible. Ugh. And it's fantastic.
This is why your country can't have nice things, Graham. This is just... could you also, Graham, just describe the drink that you had? It was an iron brew. Would you like to tell the audience what that is as well?
That's a very... Nobody knows what iron brew is. it's a sort of fruity... Back in the day, they used to say it was made out of girders, which was just marketing speak, but it's it's fruity. It doesn't really taste of anything in particular, but I'm led to believe that Scotland is the only country in Europe where Coca-Cola isn't the best-selling fizzy drink, soda, and in fact, it's iron brew. So it's hugely popular here, and you can't have anything from the chip shop without having iron brew.
Wow. Speechless. That was wonderful. If you didn't put that on your Twitter already, Graham, please do. And also, we learned of your game-watching habit. We're the Total Soccer Show. We watch a lot of soccer games. It's our job, and we enjoy doing it very much. But we learned that you watch quite a lot of games per weekend. How many games have you watched this weekend, Graham?
So I counted it up, and it was... I did watch three this morning before we did this podcast, but if we're including those, it was 16 or 17, I think, maybe, for the weekend, which is, I guess, rather a lot. But... Not in the UK, we can't have 3 p.m. games on, so I actually have a period where I don't watch games, but I'll double up with two or three at the same time for most of the weekend. Yeah.
So you're dual screening these. These aren't like back to back.
Oh, they are back to back, just normally with two or three all at the one time. So
I just picture when there is that 3 p.m. break that Graham just sits there in the exact same position and stares at a vacant television until soccer resumes and then he powers back on. That's how I picture this working out.
I mean, that is pretty much true, because I put on Soccer Saturday, which in the UK is the compromise where a lot of men sit around and watch the games and tell you what's happening. So, yeah, that pretty much is a blank screen. And yeah. So
to be clear, Soccer Saturday is retired professionals watching a screen and telling you what they're watching on the screen. That's how they get around 3 p.m. blackouts in the UK. It's as fun as it sounds. Graham, also you told us that is your dedication to soccer and covering it, that you spent part of your wedding day covering a game.
Yeah, that's 100% correct.
I remember the game as well.
So I think the ceremony, my wedding ceremony, was maybe 3 o'clock, I think.
During the blackout,
So Eurosport, who I work for at the weekends, they asked if they didn't know I was getting married that day, and they said, are you free to do a shift that day? I said, yeah, if it's an early shift. So I finished at about 2 o'clock, I think, and it was fine. It helped with the nerves. It was good. I actually remember the game that was on. It was West Ham versus Manchester United, and West Ham won. Taylor, if you remember that game at the London Stadium, that was the day.
I remember nothing.
Graham, you weren't free that day. You weren't free that day. That was the answer.
I was. I wasn't doing anything up until the ceremony.
Graham Rotham, everybody, part of the Total Soccer Show. His adventures continue. Stay tuned. Gents, why don't we turn our attention? We're going to be talking about a lot of soccer from the weekend. We've got some Bundesliga coming up, some Serie A. We're going to go to MLS as well, amongst other things. We'll start off, why don't we, in the Premier League. Manchester City smashed Norwich 5-0. Lots of work to do for Daniel Farke's side there. Jack Grealish got his first goal in that game, by the way. Delicately smashed in off his knee. He totally meant to do it. Spurs won the Nuno Derby with a 1-0 win at Wolves, in which Harry Kane did some soccer. Very exciting stuff. And Taylor, I'm going to go back on your vow not to talk about Man United. They kept up their tradition of not beating sides who hunker down and defend. A 1-1 draw at Southampton was the best they could manage. How did you feel about that one, Taylor? A tight 2 hours on that, please.
Yeah, I think we should go back to the conversation about dressage we were having before the show started. And I've got some hard and firm opinions about a sport that I literally know nothing about. I would rather talk about that instead of Man United. No, I feel like this was kind of the result that was expected when they played a more defensive team. I think Leeds were more open, and sort of then once they went 1-0 down, had to chase the game a bit more in this one. Man United going a goal down, I guess you could argue, fighting back to get the draw against a team that had caused them problems in the first half. But I think some of the concerns that we had talked about, largely a lack of depth at central midfield or a lack of reinforcement there, maybe rearing its ugly head if you're a Manchester United fan. And if you're not, rearing its wonderful head in this game.
Indeed. Well, that was the earlier game on Sunday. Let's focus our attention, though, gents, on the slightly later game on Super Sunday. Arsenal against Chelsea. This one finishing 2-0 to Chelsea. Perhaps the gulf in class between these sides, Joe, was bigger than the scoreline suggests. There was booing at full time from the Arsenal fans. Arsenal fans, in fact, surrounding Mikel Arteta's car as he tried to leave the stadium. They were asking him to leave the club in no uncertain terms, although there were fans of the other 19 Premier League clubs also there asking him to stay in the club. In uncertain terms. Joe, I think before we came on air, you were praising Chelsea for how good they were in this game. Was it that they were incredibly awesome, which they were, or that they faced a side who lacked in most departments?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes, Ryan. Chelsea were really, really, really good. They were playing Tuchel ball again this week. I think they were even better this week than they were last week against Crystal Palace. They were in that 3-4-3 shape. We saw Romelu Lukaku for the first time again with Chelsea, and he was good. The whole team was good. I was trying to think of some standout performers, and I know we'll talk more about Lukaku later because that is the big story from this game, but everyone from this Chelsea team was a standout performer, including their manager, Thomas Tuchel. He set them up in a way that just made them pass the ball so effortlessly, and the players were excellent moving the ball and actually executing their own tactical instructions. Arsenal, for their sake, I don't know what they were doing. I am confused. I know they're missing players, right? I know this isn't their first choice starting 11, and that will come ideally later on in the season for them. But even with that excuse noted and acknowledged, It was a poor showing from Arsenal on an individual player-by-player basis. Not that there weren't some standouts, but also from Mikel Arteta. I mean, the way that he set this team up, they had a numerical disadvantage in midfield for almost the entire game. And they tried to do different things to change it, but by the time they changed it, they were already a goal down. It just didn't make sense to me the way that they approached this game. Emile Smith Rowe had way too much defensive responsibility. He couldn't track Jorginho and Kovacic at the same time. And that's exactly what led to or part of what led to Chelsea's first goal. It made no sense to me what they were trying to do, and it made Chelsea look a lot better.
Is it just, Joe, they just had very little positional discipline? It seemed like a lot of players were all over the place and in positions where you wouldn't necessarily expect them to be, from what I could see.
Positional indiscipline for sure. And another part is just, I think their original tactical instructions didn't set them up to succeed. So they're in that 4-2-3-1 shape, Arsenal, and they've got the two wingers. They've got Pepe on the right and Saka on the left, and then they've got Martinelli up top, and then Emile Smith Rowe underneath, and the double pivot underneath those players. And the front three of sorts, we don't usually call it a front three in a 4-2-3-1, but the two wingers and then the striker were kind of standing directly in the passing lanes in front of Chelsea's three center backs. And that's fine. Block up those passing angles, step and pressure the center backs, and try to disrupt play from the front. But they didn't actually step and pressure a whole lot, number one. So they were just kind of standing in no man's land doing nothing. And then you had Emile Smith Rowe trying to do two people's jobs, and he's just one man. And Chelsea continued to play through that. Then Arsenal tried to switch and have Lokonga step forward a little bit, and then Kai Havertz opened up. And in the second half, they had Martinelli drop back, and that just created a numerical disadvantage in another place. And they were always chasing, and that led to what looked like a really weird-looking defensive shape and just a really structured and undisciplined performance from Arsenal.
Taylor, it baffles me how we've got to this place with Arsenal, with Mikel Arteta in charge. How do we get to this specific place where they are a pretty average team who seem to be quite indisciplined, who seem to maybe not be getting the best instruction, don't play particularly attractive soccer? What's going on here?
I mean, is this going to be a 7-hour podcast? Is that what we're going for? I'll give you like from this game, the things that stood out to me. I want to like go back and echo some of the things that Joe said there. I think they were trying to sort of have their front three, occasionally a flat front four, like block off the options through the middle, make it difficult for Chelsea to find any sort of balls into the feet of Lukaku. And I think Xhaka and Lokonga were key to that and sitting in front of him. But then as Chelsea start to move and try to pull Arsenal apart, they don't really have to try that hard. They do it pretty easily. And Xhaka starts trying to track I think it was usually Mason Mount that Xhaka was on. Lokonga was responsible for a couple different people, but what would end up happening is one would drop deeper, one would step higher, and suddenly there are these huge gaps. And I equate it almost, this is a very topical reference, I apologize in advance, it's the quickest one I could think of, but it reminds me of, like, do you remember the video game Frogger? The old video game where you have to, like, hop the frog across the street and not get hit by trucks? And you have to, like, wait for the gaps to open up. And it felt like Arsenal sort of were playing a game of Frogger in which all of the trucks were just stopped, and it was like, haha, can you get through? Oh, you can. You can get through really easily without us moving? Oh, well, that's sort of our fault. And I think a lot of that goes to Arteta and some of the instructions he gave them. Saka clearly being told, don't worry about tracking back. Like, that makes sense if you think you're going to be able to ping the wingbacks back because, oh, they've committed numbers forward, they're not sending them back, so we're vulnerable on the counter. But Saka didn't even really do that, and that let Reece James have acres, almost literally acres of space out wide. And then Kieran Tierney, I think for his part, was so oftentimes double teamed as a result and had to kind of try to figure out when to leave one open player to get to another open player. And the commentator for the opening goal, at least, blamed it pretty squarely on him and not closing down fast enough. But when you're tracking one player and then you have to go try to close down another wide open player, I don't really know if that's on you as much as it is the system. And so to bring it back to your question, Ryan, I think the thing that really, I'm sure Arsenal fans are already way ahead of me on this, but like, it was really strange to look at the touchline. And another thing the commentators pointed out, on the American feed at least, was that you had Mikel Arteta essentially micromanaging, is what it looks like. He's just standing there, he's coaching every single player, he's giving tons of instructions, and it's constant feedback, and it's very Pep Guardiola. We know he's sort of, that's his mentor, that's who he learned under, and so it is that style. But when it's Pep and it's Man City and they're winning, it seems much more like, oh, he's on top of everything. He never relaxes. And like, we see him having those animated conversations with his assistants on the touchlines. And it gives you this idea that everything is very serious and everything is very analyzed. And if there is a mistake 1 minute, that mistake will not happen the next minute. But when you're Arsenal and you're not winning and you do look sort of basically outcoached and outplayed, and then you see that coach on the sideline frantically coaching and trying to, it doesn't look like this sort of involved, in-depth coach. It looks more like panic to me. It looks more like a coach trying to get people to, like, no, you've got to be 2 yards over. No, remember, you've got to be deep. No, you've got to step forward. Like, it's giving tons of instruction, and it has the opposite effect to me. It ends up looking like he is trying to figure it out and get the team to play, and it looks like a manager who kind of just took over a club, and I find that very, very strange, and I'm going to assume for Arsenal fans, very not reassuring.
Very not reassuring. And on that note, Graham, I want to know how Arteta survives this and how he gets out of this. If this was Chelsea, and their first week they lost to a promoted side, and then they get completely outplayed by a fellow London team the second week, I think Mr. Abramovich would make the call, and it would be auf Wiedersehen, Tommy. So is there a different standard for Arteta, and how does he survive this?
It's quite difficult for me to speak about Arteta without verging into blistering hot takes, which I'm quite keen to avoid. I don't get Arteta, to be perfectly honest, as a manager. It's coming up for 2 years now that he's been in a job. Now we referenced for this specific match, yes, they were without a number of key players. Thomas Partey, Ben White was ill, Aubameyang's on the bench, Lacazette, Tierney goes off injured, which, by the way, is absolutely great. Scotland have got internationals coming up, and both of our brilliant left-backs are injured at the moment. That's fantastic. Martin Odegaard not involved yet. But how many of those players really would have made a difference? I would say maybe Thomas Partey is maybe the only one. And I've spoken a number of times about the sign, in my opinion, the sign of a well-coached team is when players come out of a team and the bones and the approach of a side and the style of play remains the same. There may be a drop-off in the standard of performance, but you're getting the same kind of performance. I don't get that at all with Arsenal. So in this particular match, yes, they're missing a lot of key players, but I don't get the sense that it would have been much different if those players had been there, because what is Arsenal's identity as a team? Arsenal traditionally under Wenger were a side, even when things were going poorly for them, you knew what you were going to get from them. They had a distinctive style of play. What is Arteta's vision for this team? I don't see what his vision is. I don't see what this, people have spoken about trust the process with Arteta. What is that process and what is it leading to? And I just don't see what he has done to justify the patience at this moment. I personally would have made a change probably at the end of last season and given a new manager the chance over the summer. Now Arsenal have committed to another season with Arteta. They've signed presumably players that he's wanted at the club, so they've committed to him again in that sense. And Arsenal are a real mess. Like,
I think that's part of the problem that Graham just spelled out there. Sorry, Graham, am I interrupting you?
No. I was trailing off at the end. On you go.
Basically, that like I think like I saw a bunch of Arsenal fans talking about how they just sack him and get in Antonio Conte. And first of all, like easier said than done. But even if that were to happen, Conte has a style and a system, and he wants a back three, and he wants certain players to do certain things, and that requires a lot more investment. And Arsenal don't seem like they want to do that. So I think there is that element of, we can stick with Arteta. He's going to focus on bringing through young players, and we'll get there eventually. And I think it's similar to the Man United model of, if we stick with a person long enough, eventually they figure it out and there's stability. And I think with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Man United, that it's still a question as to whether or not that will work out. And I think that's very much the case with Arsenal. The thing that would have me more concerned if I were an Arsenal decision maker, which I am not yet, we'll see how things play out. But after that first goal, after Chelsea's opener, there's another sequence, Arsenal, I think it's maybe straight from the restart, that they're possessing. Ball goes to Saka, and I think he spots an opportunity. I think it's Chelsea pretty aggressively pressing at that point. Saka thinks he has Pepe wide on the opposite side and goes for a long ball that is overhit and underhit at the same time, basically. And the entire crowd just starts booing. And in that moment, like, that is a young player who is trying to make something happen, and it's not a well-hit pass, but that's where I would be concerned, is that if the idea is we're bringing through these young players and we're going to get this core squad that will succeed, if you're letting frustration build such that when one of those players mishits a pass, they get booed and attacked, you're not building confidence. You're not building a team unit. You're building basically a bunch of people who don't want to make mistakes for fear of getting yelled at and booed. And that's not going to help build squad harmony either.
Indeed. Well, we spent a lot of time speaking about a mid-table team here. Let's talk about Chelsea for a little bit as well. Christian Pulisic not available. He's got COVID despite being fully vaccinated, we understand. This was, Joe, a really well-organized Chelsea team, as you said. You know, everyone seemed to know their jobs. Everyone seemed to know how to create space, although they were given it on quite a few occasions. And they just had so much control. When they took the lead, they seemed to very much control the pace. They took the ball as often as they wanted. Jorginho seemed to be really special in the middle. And Joe, Lukaku, pretty good, isn't he?
Very, very pretty good. Ryan, I agree with your analysis completely. Jorginho's hair kind of throws me off, but it does make it easy to see him on the field. So I guess I appreciate that about his game. It makes him stand out. But with Lukaku, yeah, I mean, you're spot on. He is unreal. And we knew he was going to be unreal, right? Graham, I read your piece about Lukaku. I think you were the one who wrote this. Shoot, now I can't remember. About Lukaku making Chelsea
just
a really
competitive
team. Okay, all right, Graham wrote it. We're just going to say Graham wrote it. It didn't. It didn't. So it couldn't have been Graham. That's a good point. Lukaku makes Chelsea a more complete team. And it doesn't take a genius to be able to see that. But we really saw it play out in this game on Sunday. He has this gravitational pull, right? And every soccer player has a gravitational pull in that when they receive the ball, you're going to step to them to an extent, right? With Lukaku, you're really going to step to him, because if you don't, he can turn and he can drive at you. And Graham, I know you say this, Lukaku's extremely dangerous when he's running towards a backline or running towards, you know, open space in transition. We see that with Belgium, and we're going to see that with Chelsea. He's also dangerous in possession, and he just makes it so that defenses have a lose-lose situation. Do we step to him and open up space other places or allow him to receive the ball and then pin us and spin us? Or do we leave him open, let him receive the ball between the lines, and then turn and drive forward and play point guard? It is a lose-lose situation. Lukaku gets a goal here by receiving the ball, and he does good work in the box. He was impactful deeper down the field in the attacking half, still getting on the ball. I mean, he has that dummy that is a part of the second goal. He's phenomenal. He is already easily one of the best strikers in this league, and he was always going to be. Chelsea are scary, folks.
I think with, we all know how good Lukaku is, but there's just something about coaches and managers. There's something about them that sometimes scrambles their minds, the managers and how they use them. And so that was the interesting part of this game for me was, does Tuchel, I anticipated he would know how to use him, but just for to be certain, does Tuchel know how to use Lukaku? And I think we got an emphatic yes, he knows how to use Lukaku. There was a point in the second half, I tweeted this out, and it might have been in that article as well that I wrote, Joe. There was a point in the second half when Tuchel had Lukaku out on the right wing with Havertz playing through the middle, and that was an uh-oh moment for me, where that was confirmation. Tuchel knows how to use Lukaku. He knows that he is more than just the Joseph, the player that Jose Mourinho saw him as, which was this kind of front man to hit with long balls and crosses. And Lukaku actually has improved his hold up game a lot. He can actually play that way. But Tuchel knows you want to get Lukaku running at opposition defences. And that's scary. That's scary for the rest of the Premier League. It makes, for me, Chelsea the title favourites. Not just the fact they've made that signing, but that Tuchel knows how to use him. And they've just got so many different options, Chelsea, now. You know, they can play in the rapid counter-attack, or they can control the ball through Jorginho and Mount. They can play a tight, compact front three of Havertz, Mount, Lukaku, or they can stretch their front three across the pitch with wingers. They can go physical or they can go technical. They can speed things up or they can slow things down. And the most impressive aspect of their performance against Arsenal was that Chelsea toggled between all those different approaches in the same match. And that control of being able to do different things, not just over the course of a season, but within the one match, is hugely impressive. And as the biggest contrast, I mean, I know you can look at the quality of the players between Chelsea and Arsenal, but that, for me, is the biggest contrast between those two teams, is just the level of coaching and that control that Chelsea have in all those different styles and methods.
And another facet, Graham, their depth as well. Mount, Havertz and Kovacic coming off for Kante, Ziyech and Werner. That's quite good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad. And again, that just that those changes that just give them a different way to play. I mean, Werner can play in the Lautaro Martinez role alongside Lukaku. You know, Ziyech is more of a creator who'll cut inside. Hudson-Odoi, who I know didn't come on here, he's more of a winger. He's got good deliveries as well. They've just got so many different options. And that's why I say Chelsea might not win the title, because City are an excellent team and Liverpool are an excellent team and Man United are potentially an excellent team, but Chelsea are the most complete team. I don't really see a weakness. I can point at where weaknesses are in City's team and in Liverpool's team. I can't really do that with Chelsea. And there's talk they're going to add Jules Koundé as well to their back line. So yeah, a scary, scary team at the moment.
Taylor, can you argue that?
Not since like that second season of Jose Mourinho have I been this scared of a Chelsea team. Like, genuinely, I don't know how you beat them. And Lukaku coming in, Graham, to your point, like, did you see the photo of him when he was at Man United and clearly what Jose Mourinho wanted him to be versus what he is now?
I didn't. No. Please elaborate.
He is probably like 30 pounds of muscle more for Manchester United. But that does a certain thing if you want them to be a target striker. But if you want them to be mobile and agile at the same time as being like physically imposing, that's not going to do it. And he is just such a more complete striker now, and a lot of that goes to Antonio Conte. But I just picture Thomas Tuchel saying to him, like, okay, sometimes I need you to hold it up. Yeah, that's fine. Sometimes I need you to get on the end of a cross. Also fine. Sometimes I need you to run in behind. Totally fine. Like, it's just every single thing he needs his forward to do, Lukaku can do, and I don't really know how you can game plan for that. I think he is going to be so incredible, and I think the other key part of this for me was his relationship with Mateo Kovacic is already really strong, that Kovacic, you could see, is turning as quickly as he can and immediately looking to the feet of Lukaku, because he can fire that ball in 30, 40, 50 yards, and Lukaku brings it down immediately or settles it with one touch. And if you can just have that relationship and bypass everything your opponent is doing by playing it into a forward who can hold the ball up, but can run in behind, but can lay it off, but can get a shot. Like, I don't know how you handle that. And I think Chelsea just look so comprehensively good. I had concerns about, will Tuchel burn them out? And maybe that's still a concern, but certainly not right now.
Certainly not right now. Chelsea looking pretty good. And they are top of the league as it stands after two games, that all-important two-game table that we're looking at right now. We'll be back very shortly after these messages with some Bundesliga.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey folks, this is Taylor from the Total Soccer Show, reminding you that we are inching ever closer to the start of the summer transfer window, which means there are teams that will buy and sell their players early, there are teams that will leave that business very late, and there are teams that will operate in between. But no matter what, it's going to be a chaotic situation. There's going to be offers coming through willy-nilly. There's going to be transactions to be tracked and processed and make sure that enough money is there. There's going to be probably angry clubs calling to complain. There are many things to deal with. And unfortunately for those clubs, there is no sort of business tool that makes things easier, makes transactions simpler, gets the business done efficiently and effectively. But for the small businesses around the globe, there is such a service, Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek kits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And I really appreciate that about Shopify. No matter how big you are, no matter how fast you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify's the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. That's as many countries as we'll be selling players in the transfer window this summer. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/TSS, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking Bundesliga. Bayern Munich got their first win of the season, a 3-2 win over Cologne. Serge Gnabry bagging the winner in that one. Borussia Dortmund, meanwhile, lost 2-1 to Freiburg. They kept Haaland and Daniel Malen under wraps very nicely. Bayer Leverkusen, they steamrolled Gladbach 4-0 to get a win on the board for the first time this season. Wolfsburg, they top the league. They are the Bundesliga's Chelsea right now after all so many games being played in this league. A 2-1 win at Hertha and a 1-0 win over Bochum last week puts them top of the league. But the team we are going to focus on for now, Mr. Taylor Rockwell, are the two teams, I should say, RB Leipzig and Stuttgart. Leipzig getting a 4-0 win over Stuttgart in this one. Two American coaches here, Marsh and Matarazzo, going at it. Apparently, Tyler Adams and Pellegrino Matarazzo were born only 50 miles apart in Wappinger, New York, and Wayne, New Jersey, respectively. And the other thing I know about Wayne, New Jersey, is it's where the band Fountains of Wayne are from, and it was a store in Wayne, New Jersey. Fact.
Was it a fountain store? Could you buy various fountains there?
I believe that was the nature of the store. It'd be very misleading if it wasn't.
I was joking. There are fountain stores? All right, I've learned new things. Yes, this was a very exciting game. I was showing it to my wife and saying, like, yeah, they're coached by an American. Oh, they're also coached by an American. And there's an American playing. It was a very, very exciting thing, which I'm sure is, you know, a normal thing for people who are English or Spanish or Italian or German. But for an American, it was cool to see two American coaches coaching in the Bundesliga. Less cool to see one of them getting destroyed by the other one. But also, given the way Leipzig started their opener, it was good to see them playing well, getting some fortunate goals, but also some really good like kind of team build-up goals. And it made me happy and sad at the same time.
Well, I'll tell you who was happy here. Mr. Zobeslai got there in the end,
so
kind
good.
Of. Didn't he have a good one, Graham?
I'm not the only one, but I'm such a fan of Dominic Szoboszlai. It feels like he really could be the face of Jesse Marsh's RB Leipzig team. It feels like, to me anyway, he's the player in that squad with the highest ceiling. It wouldn't surprise me. Not that RB Leipzig are a small club or playing at a low level or anything like that, you know, Champions League club, but it really wouldn't surprise me to see him at one of the biggest clubs in Europe pretty soon. His first start for Leipzig, I believe, in this match, and two goals. His second one slightly fortunate, although I did love the way he kind of, it was kind of like a golf shot.
Did he mean it, Graham? Did he mean it?
No, he didn't mean it. That's a cross into the box, but it's a good cross, and it obviously finds its way in at the back post. But his first goal is magnificent, the way he kind of bends it, guides it into the far corner from just inside the box. And you just get a sense this guy is going to be special. He seems to have been integrated really quickly into this Leipzig team. The way that Marsh has got his front four, I guess if you want to call it, an attack, all interchangeable. Andre Silva is kind of the apex of the attack in the way that Leipzig maybe haven't had in recent seasons. He's more of a kind of orthodox striker, but they've got Forsberg and Szoboszlai and Nkunku behind him, all interchangeable, all switch positions. Just a nightmare for opponents to keep track of. And we saw that. I think in particular, was it the second goal where there was all the kind of flicks and tricks and yeah. they kind of danced through the Stuttgart defence and Forsberg kind of burst through and toe pokes it into the back of the net. The fact I'm calling it a toe poke kind of does a disservice to the quality of the goal because it was a magnificent goal and just summed up what I think Marsh wants this Leipzig team to be.
Yeah, definitely. That front four is looking very, very impressive. Joe, what about Tyler Adams? I seem to remember he had a pretty decent chance early on and a good performance from him as well.
Absolutely. I tweeted out something because I watched this game after it had happened. It happened on Friday and I watched it on Saturday morning. And I hadn't seen much about the performance. I knew the scoreline and all that good stuff. But I was paying special attention to Tyler Adams, as I often do. And I tweeted out something to the effect of, man, I've never noticed Tyler Adams look this confident and be this effective on the ball with his passing. Because Taylor, you and I kind of talked about this last week on our American Weekend Review and how I wanted to pay more attention to what he's doing on the ball to see if maybe he's improving in that area. Because I'd almost, and this is wrong, but I'd almost in the back of my mind written Tyler Adams off as a plus 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 passer. And he's not that right now, but it really does
Joe,
seem
what
to
is
me
plus,
like he's
plus,
getting
plus
better.
Passer?
Real good. Just like really, yeah, I mean, imagine you're taking notes like scouting somebody. If somebody's bad, you probably put a minus next to them. If they're good, you put a plus next to them. So
I genuinely thought that was like an XG thing.
Is that a new stat?
I don't know.
Yes, it is. Just kidding. I just made it up and it's really cool.
Nice.
And
I
you
like
have to
it.
Pay
like
to hear
it.
More about it. So with Tyler Adams, he was pulling out passes that I just haven't seen him do a whole lot before. I don't have the specific minute, but I remember this moment where he's receiving the ball and he looks off a defender. He looks one way and he turns his hips one way and then he passes another way. And that's like a Busquets type of play. And I'm not saying Tyler Adams is Busquets. Michael Bradley and Will Trapp do those things too. And we know those players aren't Sergio Busquets either. But it is the trait of a player who is growing more comfortable on the ball and is starting to be able to manipulate defenders with his eyes and with his hips to create more space. And that's something you love to see from a number six. It's something that Jesse Marsh is going to love to see. It's something that Greg Berhalter is going to love to see. I've just been really encouraged by the start of this 2021 campaign. I've been encouraged by what I've seen from Tyler Adams so far this season.
That was some plus, plus, plus analysis there, Joe. Thank you very much. Taylor, what do you make of this team in terms of their potential challenge on Munich then based on what we've seen in this game?
I don't know if they will have enough like overall talent, overall depth to challenge for Bayern Munich and whoever else. Wolfsburg, obviously, are the main title
That's
contenders right.
right
now. But like this, it's a team that probably is going to sneak up on you for all the reasons that Joe and Graham have already expressed. That they don't have that sort of like marquee name that you have to be really terrified of and pay attention to. Like maybe that's Silva, but I don't even think of him as this like you're definitely putting him on the advertisement when you want to sell the game. I think it's mostly the team playing as a unit, but I think that is, to Graham's earlier point about Mikel Arteta, I think you could swap some of these guys out and some of these new players who are coming in. They seem like they kind of have an idea of what's being asked of them based on the position or where they are on the field, and I think that that's what young players need, and that's what a young team needs. And I think they will be very good because they're going to be so difficult. And then he does seem to be getting good performances out of players like Szoboszlai, who he has experience with, out of Tyler Adams, who seems to have taken on much more of a vocal role in this team. There were moments when players weren't stepping and weren't pressing, weren't making runs they were supposed to. And it seemed like Tyler Adams was the one who was responsible for kind of picking them up and getting them on board. And I like that level of leadership from him. And then the player who I think, like, prior to the Euros, I always thought of as like, yeah, he's good. He's been with Leipzig for forever, but he's not that next level, is Emil Forsberg. And what he did for Sweden in the Euros was really impressive. And then just continuing it in this game. And he looks at times like he is the most unplayable player on the pitch. And that is not a thing I really would have said about him in years past. And I don't want to give that all to Jesse Marsh. I'm not even sure he deserves much of the credit for that one, but I just think the way some of these players are combining and how sharp they do look, we'll see if that continues to be the case, because again, early doors, very young team, but I do think that there's not a massive drop off. We're not seeing that sort of like, oh, it's a new manager, they're changing their style, we got to give them some time. I think the reason you bring in somebody like Jesse Marsch, who has experience in the Leipzig system down or the RB system down the line, is that he can kind of come in, make a few tweaks to fit his style or his approach, but for the most part, it's going to be similar. And so you can kind of keep performing and then adapt and then adjust and then evolve. And I think that they've put themselves in solid position to do just that.
And another thing that was so impressive, obviously with Leipzig scoring four goals in this game, your eye is drawn to the attack. But the big question ahead of this season for Leipzig was it the back? Obviously they lost their two, you would say first choice central defenders. And Okanate had injury problems, but he was still probably there, along with Upamecano, their best central defender. Both left over the summer. Willy Orban has been at the club for you know quite a while. He's a dependable performer, so that's one position nailed down. He had a decent game, but then Simakan, who had an excellent game alongside Orban, and you just think, my goodness, Leipzig have done it again. They found, you know, a 21-year-old French central defender comes in from Strasbourg and Ligue 1 and looks the business. And you just question how Leipzig managed to keep doing this and other clubs are not beating them to the punch on these players. I thought he looked great, and obviously it's still early days for him at the club, but he could develop into an Upamecano / Konate style central defender for them.
And even Vario, who started for Croatia at the Euros at left back and looked a liability at times. And he is a natural center back. And I think even in those games I was saying, like, yeah, but he's mostly a center back. He's playing out of position. Like, I don't know if he would really ever thrive there. Here he is starting at left back and looks much more like solid as a performer. And I think, again, you're seeing them bring in young players, but find a way to kind of integrate them into the squad and have them perform pretty well from the start.
Simakan plays like a madman. Oh my word. I love me an aggressive center back, one little step forward and all that good stuff. He did that at like a scary level. And Graham, I agree. I think he's hugely talented and can be a really productive player for them this season. But it was to the point where I was concerned for what was going to happen if he pushed forward one more time. That's just something to keep an eye on for Leipzig fans as the season goes.
But don't you think that like that's what Leipzig need their central defenders to be like? They're so high intensity, and so like the continuity from Nagelsmann to Marsch is there in someone like Simakan.
Yeah, and that continuity, sorry, one more thing for me, Ryan, on this game. That continuity, Leipzig looked a lot more dangerous with the ball than I really expected them to. And we kind of talked about that with Adams, but that was really a team-wide thing. And Graham, you mentioned those interchangeable attacking players and that attacking midfield three behind Andre Silva. But just collectively, the center backs push forward, Orban and Simakan. The fullbacks would get wide. And we just saw this look from Leipzig that kind of convinced me, although to be fair, Stuttgart really open, but it kind of convinced me that this Leipzig team has the tools to actually cause teams some problems in possession. And for me, based off of how Marsch has coached in the past, where it is heavily about transitions, I wasn't sure how this team would shape up when they meet a more defensively inclined opponent. Not that they necessarily did in this game, but I think they have some of the building blocks to be an effective possession team, in addition to being a really, really good pressing and counter-pressing team.
Yeah, exciting stuff from RB Leipzig in this one. Their next two fixtures, however, current reigning champions Wolfsburg, after two games, are up next, and then Bayern Munich. So a couple of tests coming up for them, maybe bigger tests than Stuttgart certainly presented in this game. So we shall see. Gents, why don't we move over to Italy, which got things started. Juventus, Graham, with a pretty bonkers 2-2 draw at Udinese. Udinese were 2-0 down in this one. Ronaldo, as we mentioned at the top of the show, thought he had the winner, rips off his shirt with he got a nice header from across in, and disallowed embarrassingly for offside, so it wasn't 3-2 to Juventus that one. Roma against Fiorentina as well. Roma getting a 3-1 win on Sunday evening. My brother's former name is Tammy Abraham, two assists for his new club there. And we know he's going to be doing great there. Players are always very famously well treated by Jose Mourinho, so I'm sure he's going to be just fine with his time in the Eternal City. But why don't we focus, gents, for a little bit on Inter Milan against Genoa. Inter, another team who got a 4-0 win this weekend. No Lukaku, no problem, it seems, Graham. This Simone Inzaghi Inter seems quite similar to other previous Inters we've seen in many ways. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought there were many similarities between the way Conte set up this Inter team last season and how Simone Inzaghi did. In this match, you know, tactically, both managers like to play with a back three and wing backs. Both managers give freedom to their midfielders to break forward. See how in this game Barella and Çalhanoğlu had such an influence on this match. And I think that's one of the reasons that Inzaghi was brought in, is that the idea is he will build on what Conte did at the club. Inter don't really have the finances to rebuild, so that's probably a smart move. And yes, there are some subtle differences. I mean, the main difference was that there was no Martinez to partner Dzeko in attack, and oh yeah, Dzeko is now the Lukaku in this team, and obviously they are not exactly the same players. Dzeko is more of a orthodox front man than Lukaku ever was used by Conte, and obviously they, as I mentioned, they didn't have a front two. It was more of a midfield five and then a 1-1. So some differences, but yes, it was a very Inter performance, and I actually think that's a really encouraging thing for them. Obviously, what Conte did worked, and if they can eke a little bit more out of that, then that's probably a good thing to do.
Yeah, Taylor, do you buy into that it's quite a similar setup to what we saw last season? Bearing in mind a new manager and bearing in mind many new players here, as we mentioned, Dzeko there leading the line, gets a debut goal here. Çalhanoğlu coming in, free transfer from not very far away from Milan, debut goal here. Matteo Darmian coming in, and he got a start. Denzel Dumfries got minutes in this one as well. It seemed like they were a very clinical team here, and they were playing, as we have seen previously, but with a lot of new parts.
Yeah, and I think that's really to Inzaghi's credit, because we were just praising Marsh for this, and I think part of that is like him being in the system and being familiar with the way Red Bull franchises want to play. Here, Inzaghi is coming into a situation that was not of his own, and isn't really, it's not like his mentor set the team up and now he's taking over. And I think he's taking a very smart approach. I think he's adjusting what he wants to do to better fit the team. And I think he's playing in a way that allows the players that have been there to stay in positions that are comfortable. Essentially, I feel like he's keeping the majority comfortable, and then he himself has to adapt rather than making the entire team sort of change what they want to do to suit his style. And I think that has put him in a much better position to allow players to come in and sort of know what their role is going to be. And you look at Hakan Çalhanoğlu coming in and getting a goal, and Edin Dzeko coming in and getting a goal, or at least facilitating goals. And just, it stood out to me as just exactly how you want to start your season. And I kind of forgot when I did the preview with David Amoyal that Inzaghi at Lazio is successfully managing a club that don't have a ton of money, that aren't going to be the big spenders. And you look at some of the squads he had and how closely he ran the title, how deep he would take them in certain competitions. And they weren't, there were a lot of cast-offs. There were a lot of players who didn't have success elsewhere, came to Lazio, got backed, got belief, and found a way to win. Certainly having Sergei Milinkovic-Savic and his 19-foot-tall stature doesn't hurt, but I think he has plenty of world-class players here at Inter. And so, in some ways, this is probably the strongest team Simone Inzaghi has ever managed, whereas for Antonio Conte, it felt like a team that was being ripped apart. And I think maybe my self-reports of Inter's demise were slightly exaggerated. Not saying that they're going to win the title, not saying that they're going to be even comfortably top four. I think they will be, but I wouldn't say that with ease after one game. But I'll say that it was a much stronger performance than I was expecting.
Yeah, certainly, Joe, the Inter fans seem to be encouraged from the chatter I was monitoring online here. You know, they still believe they've got a strong squad here, still believe they've got quite a lot of depth here, which they indeed do on both counts. How do you feel about this Inter team, Joe?
They were really, really good in this game. I was pleasantly surprised at how they approached pretty much every phase of play. I don't think this iteration of Inter Milan will be as focused on counterattacking and breaking into space, although I'm sure we'll see that some. This team looked really focused on controlling the ball, and part of that's based on the opponent here in Genoa, but they looked really focused on controlling the ball and moving off the ball and rotating into space, and then when they lost the ball, they would counterpress. I mean, it looked like a really modern attacking team that didn't have a ton of clear, obvious weaknesses. I mean, some of the goals they scored were lovely. First of all, the Çalhanoğlu goal in the 14th minute was a phenomenal strike from outside the box. The Vidal goal in the 74th minute comes off of Inter high pressing, then they win the ball, then they combine in midfield, and then Barella gets this touch in the box after Edin Dzeko shoots, and Barella plays this little step over one touch pass to Vidal, who scores, and then Dzeko gets his goal a little bit later on in this game. I mean, this was a phenomenal performance from them, and it made me excited to watch more of Inter as the season goes on.
One thing I wasn't excited about, Graham, to be serious for a moment, two really bad kits on display here. Really, like that Inter kit I'm not a fan of, but the one that really got me was Genoa here, whose kits were grey, completely grey, yeah. No sponsor on them. They look like they were from the Futurama neutral planet here. I wasn't impressed at all with what either team was wearing. And with Man United playing at Southampton on this very weekend, it reminded me of the grey kits they wore, which they famously took off at halftime because he couldn't see one another. I wonder if Genoa had similar problems here.
The Genoa kit was a shocker. I'll accept that one. I like the Inter one. I think the sponsor has spoiled it a bit, but they actually released it without the sponsor, and I may or may not have bought that Inter kit.
Ooh, did you use Bitcoin?
No, I used digital bits.
That's my preferred method too, Graham. That's my
I like it. It's not as last season's Inter kit was an all-time classic. It's not quite as good as that, but I quite like the snakeskin in our kit.
And Graham, on the subject of Genoa, I consider you our North Macedonia correspondent after the Euros.
And we had this was going to come up.
Goran Pandev up top here doing his thing. What did you make of them?
Difficult for them, I think it's fair to say. I'm not sure how much analysis I can provide of Genoa, just given how little we saw of them and how little we saw of Goran Pandev. I mean, the fact he's starting this match, I'm not entirely sure what that says about Genoa, but they'll have games where they are allowed to impose themselves more than this one. We didn't see much of them.
I feel bad saying this, but like the grey kit, the lack of sponsor, but then they had like Cambiasso playing at left wing back, but not spelled the way Esteban Cambiasso is. And you had like Hernani in the middle, which like that felt like they didn't get the rights to Nani. So they had to create it felt like a sort of knockoff team across the board. I feel very bad saying that because Genoa are a club with a proud history and a proud tradition. And they've got lots of talented players in there. Just maybe not as talented when you're playing this Inter team who maybe had a point to prove.
Well, there you go. Inter beating a team from Pro Evo Soccer there this weekend.
There we go.
We'll see what happens next weekend. We're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, more soccer talk.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned. A few more leagues to chat about, gents. I wanted to just mention what happened in France this weekend. PSG won at Brest. They won 4-2. They are top of Ligue 1. No surprises there, but no Leo Messi in the squad yet there. It was Gini Wijnaldum playing behind a front two of Icardi and Mbappe in that one. Not so pleasant scenes in Marseille versus Nice. That one turned ugly. Dimitri Payet was hit by a bottle. He threw it back, which is probably never a good idea, and that led to a pitch invasion and a very various scuffles and I believe the abandonment of the match as well. So not pleasant scenes there in France for this weekend. But some more pleasantness in Spain, perhaps. Atleti atop with maximum points. Barcelona drew one apiece with their bogey team, Athletic Bilbao. Now I think about it, Athletic Bilbao, probably most La Liga teams, bogey team. But that's probably a topic for another day. But Graham, the big one probably of this weekend, Levante against Real Madrid. Gareth Bale starting, getting the opener as well. I believe he's wearing shirt number 18 and not 50 as he was not so long ago. So he's upgraded his shirt number at the very least. But Vinicius getting the equaliser in the 85th minute from a pretty outrageous angle. This game was B-A-N-A-N-A-S, was it not?
It absolutely was. This was, I mean, I know it's early days, but this was game of the season for me so far. It looked like Real Madrid were in complete control of the match at halftime with a 1-0 lead, as you mentioned, Gareth Bale, who apparently is still a thing, scoring the first goal. He's actually looked, I mean, he's not ripping up any trees or anything, but he's looked pretty decent, and Ancelotti is, obviously Bale played probably his best football for Real Madrid under Ancelotti, so he's had a second chance under him. It seems like Ancelotti has wanted to go with this Hazard, Benzema, Bale front line, which if he gets all of them fit and firing is the thing that could make Real Madrid title favourites. You know, those three are world-class talents on their day. But yeah, Real Madrid looked to be in complete control, and then Levante scored an equaliser within 30 seconds of the restart, and then another on 57 minutes, which was an outrageous finish by Jose Campagna. He meets it, the ball's played to the back post, Lucas Vazquez is nowhere to be seen, which is another sign that he's not really a right back, shall we say. But Jose Campagna's got so much to do, and he meets it, you know that way where you meet a ball on as it bounces, as it's hitting the ground, he hits it at that point and just unleashes it into the top corner of the net. It's the best finish I've seen so far this season. And then all of a sudden, Vinicius decides to become the best player in the world for 20 minutes. He equalises for 2-2, and that was not something I was expecting. And then Robert Pierre makes it 3-2 after some terrible defending by Real Madrid. And then Vinicius scores another to make it 3-3 with this sort of incredible, I don't know how to describe it, like a flipped finish off the inside of the far post. And just when you think that maybe things might calm down, then Aitor Fernandez, and I actually audibly laughed at this point because it was getting too much. There was too much craziness going on. Aitor Fernandez rushes 40 yards off his line to handle the ball to stop, I think it's Rodrigo. I think Vinicius plays the ball through to Rodrigo, who has a whole half to run into. And Aitor has no choice but to rush off his line. He handles the ball, gets sent off. Levante have made their five changes. So Vezo, an outfield player, a defender, finishes the last. I mean, it was about a solid 10 minutes of play. He plays in goal and it finishes 3-3 and everyone exhaled at the full-time whistle because this was crazy.
Graham, this was Sunday night. This is probably the 13th game of the weekend you've watched. Was there any part of you that thought this might be a fever dream when this was happening?
Yeah, especially because this happened after the Juventus-Udinese game as well. So, yeah, I did wonder if I was hallucinating at a point.
And can I ask Graham some questions on that front?
Yeah.
I'm actually... Graham, for real though, like how do you... Because I will watch a game in depth, take notes, and then when I read those notes again, I have zero recollection of the game. Like I really have to take a moment to like read the note and try to remember the thing that happened. How are you able to keep everything in your head, or do you not? Do you remember like general things from the game?
Yeah, I obviously can't remember everything that happened in the. There'll probably be some score lines there that would take me a little while to recollect what they actually were over the weekend. But yeah, general things. I think because the Spanish games, I'm working them, so I'm providing minute by minute updates of those, and then a match report. It's a little bit easier for me to remember intricately what happened, but yeah, general things.
And like, is that also how you remembered your wedding on the day that you were doing the Eurosport coverage? Was it like I just picture you having your phone like real quick, and Matic completes the pass. Okay, yeah, I do for sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm in. And then yeah, the handshake, and then on you went. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know how I say my vows, I had strange vows and they didn't actually have any emotion? It could have been the case that they did. It's just that I was providing updates on Valencia's third goal away to Leganés.
You had like, I like the idea of you having your phone on speaker, your editor's on the line, and you're having to do like the sitcom-y thing of say the vows, but also like do the update. And you're like, I love you. The way Romelu Lukaku loves to score goals for Chelsea in the 36th. But like just knowing exactly how you have to say it. I like it.
Yeah, that's the way it was.
Perfect.
I didn't even know how you fitted in a trip to the fishing tackle shop to get spruced up for the big day as well on that day. There's so much you had to do that day, Graham. Goodness me.
Yeah.
If we mention OnlyFans, we've done the full Graham Ruthven gambit, by the way, of Graham memes for this episode. So we're going very well with that. One more question on this, though, Graham, with Gareth Bale and reuniting with Ancelotti. Mm-hmm. At the Euros, Gareth Bale was telling us, you're going to be super shocked at this crazy revelation I've got coming out. And it turns out it was regular game time with his club.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that was the crazy revelation that it was going to be valuable to Real Madrid again.
What a crazy world we live in. All right, gents, why don't we turn our attention to Major League Soccer. New England, who'd have thunk it, a storm in the Eastern Conference with a 4-1 win over Cincinnati this weekend. Orlando are chasing them. They got a 1-0 win over Chicago. We thought we might be covering the Hudson Derby this weekend, but not much to report there apart from a big old rain delay of 2.5 hours before a cancellation. Feels like they could have cancelled it a bit earlier than that, but who am I to say? In the West, the Sounders are still topping it with a 2-1 win over Columbus. But Joseph, we're going to talk about the other Inter today. Inter Miami got a 3-1 win over Toronto, their fourth straight home win, as one as David Beckham's children reminded us on social media on Sunday. Apparently they're now in the playoff hunt, because sure. And Lord Beckham himself was in attendance for this one. Joe, what did you make of this? Is this a flash in the pan? They are things are looking up for Miami, or have they still got some systemic problems?
Oh, they still have some systemic problems. I feel bad being like a Miami buzzkill all the time, but it's hard to be anything else right now. The goals they scored in this game, a lot of them were just gifts from Toronto, right? Because Miami has their own set of problems. Toronto FC has their own real set of problems as well. They fired Chris Armas midseason, their new manager, their new interim manager. He's got the rest of the season. Javier Perez has actually really done a worse job than Chris Armas in a lot of ways, and I sympathize with being thrown into that spot, but Toronto is not a good team and they have a lot of problems too. The goals that Inter Miami score in this game, the first one is from Pizarro in the 15th minute. It comes after Marky Delgado's pass to Richie Larrea is intercepted, and then Pizarro gets the ball and cuts across Singh, the left center back for Toronto FC. So there's errors there. The second goal is Robbie Robinson in the first half too, and he just kind of skates past Omar Gonzalez and scores, and Omar Gonzalez at this point in his MLS career is a defensive liability. And then in the second half, it's Pizarro again, 48th minute. And it's a long ball from Leandro Gonzalez Pires over the top to Pizarro. And Singh can't control the ball, and he certainly doesn't clear the ball. He just ends up doing not a whole lot of anything. Pizarro gets the ball and scores. I mean, they were given gifts in this game, and they did some things well. They always do some things well, but every soccer team does something right in a game. I'm not at all convinced by Miami at this point, even though I think they've won 4 of their last 6 games. They haven't beaten a lot of good teams this season, throughout the entire season, and that certainly hasn't changed over the last 5-6 games.
Taylor, Joe is doubting the genius of Phil Neville there. How do you feel?
Well, I'm confused because Joe called Singh a defender, and I didn't see any of that in this game. Ouch. So I'm wondering where Joe came up with that idea.
Not great, huh?
I mean, it wasn't the best defensive display in terms of defenders trying to defend and not doing it while having giant hair. It was very David Luiz-esque in my mind. And I thought it was better from Inter Miami, certainly. I can't claim to have the familiarity that Joe certainly does with them. But, I mean, to see them trying was nice. But I think we also still saw moments of kind of like snatching at efforts or still not playing as a cohesive unit. And from my understanding, Joe, that seems to be the knock against the team, that they don't really play as a team, as a unit. They play as a bunch of kind of expensive individuals who were brought in to be good, I guess, is kind of the idea there. But
when
they combine, they look very good. When they don't, they look okay individually.
It's hard because I almost think it's more on Phil Neville than anything else. Like, it's on the coaching staff to give this team some sort of identity. Right? It's a bunch of talented individual players, but to an extent, that's every team, and every coach is faced with it's harder in Miami, but every coach is faced with the job of making them work together. And I have seen very little from Phil Neville this season that makes me think that he's able to do that in Major League Soccer, really. Miami switched over the last few games to more of a 3 at the back shape that sometimes rotates over into a 4 at the back shape. LGP was kind of the flex player on the right side. He was the right center back in moments, and he was the right back in other moments. And Graham's Lewis Morgan was the right winger, and sometimes he was the right wing back. But like there are, I mean, you can talk about their quote unquote tactics, but tactics are only useful when they're working towards a goal, when they're working towards some sort of overarching idea of how you want the game to be played. And I'm sure Phil Neville has those things. He's talked about those things publicly before. But the missing piece for Miami really isn't necessarily any one particular player that would solve their issues or any one spot that they really need to address. It's that they don't have the ability to translate Phil Neville's ideas into actionable things on the field. And that's killed them all year long. And I don't think, even if they do sneak into the playoffs, they're not a threat this season. They have some real issues to work through.
Is the key to their upturn in recent form, is it not just that they're getting more out of the kind of the star individual players that they've got? So, you know, Pizarro in this game, I'm starting to see what some of the fuss was about. I think he's got, what, 3 goals in his last 2 games. Higuain, you know, I know he's been brought in as a goal scorer, but they're getting slightly more out of him as a facilitator. A lot of, particularly in the first half, a lot of of Inter Miami's play seemed to be, you know, flowing through him. And then Perez, obviously, at the back with the 2 assists. Is it not just that they're kind of getting more out of the individuals?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it, right? When your star players or the players you brought in to be stars are playing like that and having the ball find the back of the net, that makes a big difference, right? But I just still have a hard time believing it's sustainable. You get a boost from Pizarro when he's back in the lineup, because he wasn't in the lineup for a lot of the season. And there was talks about Miami trying to offload him, and then a whole bunch of stuff went down that Paul and Sam have talked about at length on allocation disorder. And it's just, it's one thing after another for this Miami team. The one, I guess, thing I have in response to that, Graham, other than, yeah, you're right, is the last 4 wins that Miami have. So they've got 4 wins in their last 6 games. 3 of those wins have come against Montreal, who's struggling a little bit right now. They've had a really nice season for them overall. But Montreal's been 1 win. Chicago, not a good team. Toronto, not a good team. So it's production, but it's production against teams that just aren't a whole lot better than they are. And I think if you're Miami, you need to beat teams above you, like really above you in the table. And they're still not doing that stuff.
So what you're saying is that Ryan shouldn't add Inter Miami to his list of wagers for Inter Miami to win MLS Cup. Correct. Alongside Manchester United to win the title and Vieira to get sacked first. he shouldn't add them to that list.
No, I would not, Ryan. I would not.
All right, Joe, if Miami had come to you and asked you for your consulting services when they had their 5 DPs, but let's go with the 4 main DPs, which would you have told them to get rid of? Because I don't know if they got rid of the right one.
So Pellegrini's gone, right? And another one was Andres Reyes, who is also gone. Those are 2 of the kind of lower end DPs. And then it's Matuidi, Pizarro, and Higuain.
Yeah.
All of them, really? I mean, it's hard because Pizarro is the guy
said it in jest, right? Joe said it seriously.
I did, genuinely, because Pizarro is such a sort of fluid player. He really needs a system around him to give him that platform to succeed. Miami doesn't have that. He'll still score goals. He scored 2 in this game, obviously, but he's not really a star number 10 in a traditional sense. Higuain is old and doesn't move like I think a lot of folks hoped he would. And Matuidi, the same things I just said about Higuain apply. So, yeah, I have questions about Miami, Taylor.
Joe, another...
I do too. Sorry, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say another hypothetical for you. Let's say we start Lowry Chester Rovers. You've got your own team and you have to pick a manager. And the 2 available are Phil Neville and Mikel Arteta. Who do you pick?
Arteta. Arteta. That is, first of all, I'm going to change the name. I don't know what it's going to be, but
Poison
it's probably
Chalice
not going to be.
Poison Chalice FC is what that's called.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be Poison Chalice FC. And I'm just going to sell. I'm selling. I don't want to make that decision.
Fair enough. Taylor, did I interrupt you there, sir?
I'm just thinking of more Scylla and Charybdis FC. That's a Greek myth one for you all if you want that one.
So high brow.
Paul's piece for The Athletic about Inter Miami, how they built, what they did, why they did what they did. We Lost a Brand, Not a Team is the title. If you have an Athletic subscription, you should absolutely read that.
Yeah.
And I will admit, reading that before watching this game probably biased me pretty considerably, but the way it seems like there's no clear decision maker anywhere with the organization, I think you see that on the field, it bleeds down. And so, Joe, to your point, like, yeah, they it's a shame that Phil Neville can't kind of get his ideas across or people aren't buying into it, but it also seems to be the case that it goes above him to, like, David Beckham saying, hey, that guy's my buddy. Can we sign him? And then they did, and he was a DP. Like, it's a strange series of decisions behind this club.
It shouldn't be any surprise that they have the systemic problems that Joe is talking about, given, as you referenced there, Paul's piece in The Athletic, Taylor, where they seem to be initially focusing on, you know, the Atlanta United route of focusing on South American young talents with sell on value, and then all of a sudden immediately pivoted towards signing Higuain and Blaise Matuidi.
Hey, but you know, Ryan Shawcross and Kieran Gibbs, they changed it up this year, man.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, that really changed things.
Kieran Gibbs scored a great poacher's goal, to be fair, just in the wrong net in this game. Is all.
There we go.
One final note on this game for our Canuck friends, Toronto, who are winless in their last six outings. Graham, I'll ask you this. What is worse? Singh's defending in this game, he got, on whoscored.com, he got a 4.9. I don't remember ever seeing a score that low for a professional player.
Oh, wow.
Which is yikes. Or Achara up top wearing number 99. What's worse?
I'm still going to say the defending. At least 99 is, you know, two nines. It's a bit contrived, but the defending was so bad this game. Although Achara, I thought he was just left on his own for much. Any time a ball was played in, there seemed to be five Inter Miami players around him, and even the goal they score comes from a situation like that. So if we're factoring his play in as well, and I don't know how much was his fault, but we'll say Achara.
All right. Well, there's certainly work to do in Toronto, maybe some in Miami as well, but no more work left to do for us gents in this podcast, because we have just about reviewed that old weekend. Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for stopping by.
Listeners, thank you all very much for stopping by as well, and apologies if you've heard the baby crying in the background for the last 20 minutes, because that's been an ever-present fixture.
That's a rude way to talk about Joe Lowry, but thank you very much, Joe.
Oh, Ryan, you're so welcome. That was great.
And Graham Ruthven, please don't watch as many games next weekend. We want you to be around longer.
I've got to head off now to watch some more.
I bet you.
I just picture you with the like Clockwork Orange, like your eyes are taped open, you're dropping in drops occasionally just to make sure you're catching everything all the time.
Yeah, that is pretty much spot on, except it's just cans and cans of Red Bull.
And Iron Brew, of course, Graham. And Iron Brew, of course.
Of course.
All right. Thank you very much, listener. We'll be back soon. Bye.